Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inspiring Leadership Podcast, brought to you by Pursue Limited, coaching specialists with a mission to revolutionise professional development across the global education sector by harnessing the power and potential of coaching. My name is Nicholas Mackay, professional certified coach and director of Pursue, and I'm going to be your host as we aim to bring you some of the best thinking in education and beyond, getting insights into inspiring leadership. In this series, we are proud to once again be in partnership with Independent School Management Plus and International School Magazine, the leading authority and voice for professionals in independent and international education worldwide. And if you'd like to watch the video of today's podcast, please head over to schoolmanagementplus.com. So let's go on with today's episode, and I'm delighted to welcome Chandani Misri, who is the head of senior school at Repton School, Al Barsha, Dubai. Chandani read chemistry at Keble College, University of Oxford, before venturing into a career in broadcast journalism at BBC News 24 and later teaching. Her leadership experience began in inner city contexts in the UK and later incorporated the competitive international school landscape of Dubai. Chandani remains a STEM enthusiast, and alongside strong academics, she believes in the power of harnessing students' enthusiasm through positive relationships, inspirational teaching, and an enriched curriculum. Chandani, thank you so much for joining me today from Dubai.
Thank you, Nicholas. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. And I've been wanting to get you on the pod for a while now, Chandani. And as we spoke about before, we've had a bit of a break from doing the podcast. So I'm delighted that you can come on. And just before we kick off, we had a quick chat around Chandani, didn't we? And what it means, I suppose, in terms of the translation. So do you want to kind of, I thought that was really interesting, maybe have a little chat about that.
Yeah, so Chandani means moonlight. It's a Hindi word. I was born in India, so my parents actually named me after a Bollywood film. And quite often, if I meet anyone from India, they will ask me straight away, Chandani, is that after the film? Yes, yes, it is. After the famous movie called Chandani that was released the year that I was born. But yes, it does mean moonlight. I know it can stump quite a few people in terms of pronunciation. I've had lots of different variations of the name, but yes, Chandani.
Chandani, me included. So really interesting to sort of unpick a little bit about your journey, Chandani, into, you know, where you currently are. So one thing that jumped out at me when we had an initial chat was that journalism experience for BBC News 24. So just take us through a little bit about that experience.
Oh, I had a great time. I've been very fortunate in really enjoying every job that I've done, but I've now found the best one in the world. I studied a chemistry degree at university because I loved maths and science, and I had very inspirational teachers, and went from an all-girls school to finding myself the only girl in my cohort at my college studying chemistry. So that was quite a challenge. And during my degree, loved getting involved in the practical side of the course. Really enjoyed the physical chemistry and the maths. But during that time, got interested in the student radio station. So I used to newsread on the student radio station. That just became a bit of a passion project of mine. And then I later worked as an intern with BBC News 24. Loved it. It was nowhere near as glamorous as it might sound. Lots of umbrella holding, lots of making coffees, lots of long hours, but really enjoyed it. Really, really did enjoy it. And when the BBC relocated their headquarters to Salford, I started to pursue other journalism jobs in London. At the time, having just got engaged, I wanted to stay in the city. And I started to think about what could fit nicely into a year that would allow me to look for another broadcast journalism role. And teacher training seemed to fit very nicely into 1 year. And I then thought, if I'm going to teach, I want to have as much impact as possible. So I chose a school in Tower Hamlets, a large Teach First cohort in that school, and absolutely fell in love. I still remember the deputy head teacher took me around on a tour, and we walked past year 11 class in a lab, and he said, do you know anything about chemical equilibria? And I was like, yeah, I know a bit about chemical equilibrium? And he's like, in you go, off you go. Can you teach these year 11s a bit about it? So that was it. And I went into that classroom and I talked to them about the fact that teenagers would oppose any change that was imposed upon them in the same way that a system might. And something just clicked in that classroom and I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And as I pursued my teacher training, boy, was it hard. It was very challenging. I learned a huge amount. Fantastic team of teachers in that school. I mean, it underwent huge amounts of improvement, rapid improvement. But partway through my training, I turned to my husband one evening and I said, this is it. I'm not going back into journalism. I found what I want to do. So that was it. And I've never looked back.
So just in terms of that, you said you found what you wanted to do. So what was it about teaching, do you think, that made you come to that realization?
I think it's impact. You can have a conversation with one student and you can see the impact of it and feel the impact of it very, very quickly. And there's a lot of roles that have incredible amounts of impact too. But there's something about that immediate connection and in feeling the immediate impact of what you're doing. And there's a lot of teaching that is a slow burn. Takes a long time sometimes to see the fruits of our labor, particularly because human behavior is just so nuanced. We're working with young people, and particularly as a secondary school teacher, working with adolescents where there's just a lot going on for these young people. So, but there is something about that. You leave a classroom and you can, it's tangible, the impact that you've had on those young people. I think that is almost quite addictive, actually. You crave it. I love being in the classroom, even now as a school leader. Those are the highlights of my days when I'm back in the classroom still teaching a bit of science.
How much do you teach currently?
So I teach a lovely year 9 class and a year 8 class at the moment. Oh. So a handful of hours a week, but I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's one of those. I remember going back many years now, and I suppose I sound old, but when I was leading schools, going back into the classroom was just so enjoyable. And closing that door in a way just brought it back to me. I remember, you know, very vividly that this is great stuff. You know, I haven't got any more of those, the kind of admin-y bits to do and the administration stuff, which I enjoyed sometimes. But getting back into the classroom and connecting with people was really something that you just can't beat, can you?
No, nothing comes close, really. I think as you move into leadership, there's a perception that, okay, you take on a lot more that is outside the classroom, and really should great teachers just stay within the classroom? And I think there is an opportunity in leadership. You shape the culture, and the culture of an organization really is everything. And the more and more I look into that, the more conversations I have with other school leaders who inspire me, who I get to meet all the time. I'm very fortunate to be able to do so, particularly over in Dubai. There's a huge number of schools, but there's a huge number of fantastic school leaders. And culture really is everything. It's not just something that leaders shape. It's everything in an organization, in a school. It's tangible for students. It's tangible for parents, everybody who sets foot in there. So as much as I do still love being in the classroom, and I'm not in the classroom as much as I used to be, There are other facets that I get to shape the classroom with.
And we'll just hold that thought for a minute around culture, because I think we'll come back to that. But let's, again, rewind a little bit. You're in Tower Hamlets. You're getting into your profession. You're enjoying it. You've made the decision to kind of leave journalism. So what happened next?
So I was teaching GCSE Key Stage 3 and some A-level chemistry as well, and I was teaching science at GCSE, all three sciences, and all three sciences at Key Stage 3 too, and quite quickly started to find that I connected with the classroom. And I think particularly in teacher training, it's hard going, and I did a GTP, so you're learning on the job. Very similar.
I did a GTP as well, Chandani.
Okay. So yeah, you know how it is.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So yeah, learning on the job in the classroom, making tons of mistakes, getting it wrong a lot, and then learning those small nuanced ways to get it right. I think it helps when there are a lot of other trainee teachers in a school and you're kind of in it together. There was a real community of support. And some great mentors in the school as well, and also good role models for leadership. But As I started to realize I was having impact in the classroom, the students were making progress. It was a rapidly improving school and leadership opportunities came my way. So during my NQT year, I led on Key Stage 5 science in the school, and the school then also opened a new sixth form. So huge learning curve there. And then later became deputy director of sixth form, which I loved as well. So then I started to get to look at university applications. And for a lot of those students, it was the first generation going off to university.
Yeah.
Still fills me with pride to think about some of those wonderful, wonderful young people. And thereafter, having done that for a couple of years, I had to move with my husband's job. So he relocated to the north of England. And therefore I had to, and I still say to this day, there is never a good time to leave a school. I find it's heartbreaking every time I leave a school. Even if you're pursuing another great opportunity or for whatever reason it is, it's really hard because it's such a personal connection with everything you do in your workplace. So moved to the north of England. And again, that was my first SLT role. So I was assistant principal of Leeds City Academy in Woodhouse. So that was Leeds, still classed as kind of an inner city school, but I got to see the difference between challenging inner city school in London, where there was a London challenge and a lot of schools were actually doing very well. And then the difference to with an inner city school in Yorkshire, very different community as well. So, again, very challenging and my first SLT role, but I was very fortunate to be in a very good team. Very inspirational principal at the time as well. And she really did take me under her wing. And we went through inspections. We went through so many wonderful life-changing journeys for the students who, you know, gone from a school refuser to later getting their GCSEs and feeling so proud about going to college, but still a very different cohort, different demographic to what was in London. In London, the school was located near Shoreditch, so the students would walk to school and probably walk past some techie entrepreneur hipsters on the way and start to see where education could take them. And they've got Canary Wharf in the skyline.
Yeah.
Whereas it wasn't quite the same in Woodhouse. Mm. You know, it was a challenge to engage families in the value of education. But once you had them, it's just fantastic to see the impact of that.
And I suppose just pausing on that, you mentioned about the principal being inspirational. So what was it about the principal that you found inspirational?
I talk a lot to my students about this, and I think it's humility. She was incredibly humble, and I think there is a misconception that it's the TED talkers and the very extrovert school leaders that are the most memorable and the most successful. And she just wasn't like that. She was incredibly humble. She didn't say much more than she needed to. And she was very good at listening, really actively listening to the team and listening to others. And I think when I moved into SLT, and particularly now in my first headship, it can be lonely. It can be lonely. It's very different to being a classroom teacher with your team around you all the time. And what can happen, I think, if you're not actively listening, is you risk becoming your own echo chamber in a way. So if you really want the buy-in and to have a positive culture, then I think that active listening is really important. And humility is required for that, because we don't have all the answers. We have to look to others. We have to have conversations that allow us to be innovative with solutions. So, yeah, I would say humility. And I speak to my students a lot about that. Humility, what does it look like? Because it's not when you're humble, no one notices. So, but it's still so important. So, reinforcing that, I think humble leadership was what really struck me about her.
So what does being humble look like then to you?
I've seen different leaders talk about it in different ways. And one of the things that struck me from a principal in Dubai, actually, who said this to me, he talked about path sweeping. And he said that he said this to me before I started this role, actually. He said, view what you do as like path sweeping for everybody in your organization. You are trying to make their day as smooth as possible. And for a teacher, that would mean you're sweeping the path so that they can just get into their classroom and do what they love. For students, you're sweeping the path so that they're not carrying lots of unnecessary, potentially emotional burdens. You know, you're trying to ease that for them so that once they're in the classroom, what they can focus on is their learning and their love of the subject. So I think path sweeping, because it's not a showman's job, but it's very important. So I would describe it in that sense. You know, it's path sweeping for everybody in the organization. I think that's humble leadership.
And I suppose just before we come on to school culture, I'm always really curious to understand when people sort of maybe have a career before teaching, some of the transferable skills. So you mentioned your journalism at BBC News. So what skills do you think you draw upon, even maybe now, in terms of your role that kind of have come from that previous experience?
I think storytelling. So a lot of journalism was based around storytelling, communicating information. And this, the idea of transfer, I know there's a hot debate on transferable skills. I think it helped me develop the attributes that meant that when I moved into teaching, I was highly aware of the fact that long hours would be required if I wanted to do this well. Significant amounts of planning in order to just communicate something effectively, because that's the heart of teaching. We are trying to communicate quite complex ideas to young people, and also at the same time trying to do it in a way that they enjoy. And it's not always easy, given the complexities of every single individual in the classroom and the different ways that they learn. So I think storytelling, it's not as dissimilar as you might think moving from journalism into teaching, because you are still trying to convey a message to the students and incite some passion. Get a reaction, a positive reaction from them.
Yeah, and I suppose that links to vision as well, isn't it? Whether you're a leader and that storytelling, getting people on board and getting people coming with you on a journey, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The buy-in is so important. And particularly, we are a growing school. So we're up to year 9 at the moment, and we will grow organically year on year. So there is a real excitement, but you have to keep that vision very clear about where we're headed. What are we creating year on year? What are we trying to establish year on year? And there's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of momentum, but it comes from good leadership. You can only get that professional enthusiasm with strong leaders. You very rarely walk into a school and see teachers who are not very enthused with their role, but then see amazing leaders who are just, it depends on the stage where the school is at, but the leadership has a huge impact on that. I think you can get that professional enthusiasm with clear vision, with integrity, that then shapes the culture of the rest of the organization and the students within it as well. They feel it.
I suppose just on that, we've come at full circle here, but in terms of a positive culture, which you've mentioned, what does that look like to you?
Well, I do a lot of reading around this, and outside of education too, very interested in leadership. But I can't remember who said it, but they said that the best organizations work like families. And I think that's true, because you have each other's back, you support each other. But you know that there will be times when you need to have a challenging conversation. But you have each other's best interests at heart. And I think that's how I try to view and shape the culture in the school. And there is a strong sense of community when you walk into a school. You can feel it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I love hearing visitors when they come and see us say, is there is a real strong sense of community in this school. And that has to be palpable amongst leadership, amongst the teaching staff, amongst the students, that everybody has their best interests at heart. And if that means we have to challenge each other and have conversations, then so be it. But we're actively listening, we're actively supporting each other, and we work with integrity. And I think part of that is also being vulnerable. This is my first headship, and I will I will openly say it's challenging. It's really hard. You're faced so much, and I know school leaders are across the globe at the moment, with difficult decisions, and you have to go with it, and you have to be open to the fact that you might make mistakes. But when you do that, and when your staff see that you have that humility, I know I've come back to humility now, but then I think they're more likely to buy into you.
So in terms, you know, you've been very honest about the fact that, you know, very new head. So how's it going?
It's great. No, I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. I'm learning a huge amount. I'm fortunate to have a fantastic team of governors who are very, very supportive, but exactly in the way that I mentioned. It is like a family, you know, challenge me. And I have a school principal who's very much like a mentor to me as well. And the relationships I've built in Dubai, even from my previous school, which was Jumeirah College, I'm still very, very close to that school, very close to every school I've worked at, really. I'm still in touch, still love to know what's going on. But I think it's really important to have experienced leaders around you that you can go to. And sometimes it even helps when they're not in your context, which is why I think coaching is also really, really valuable. Mm-hmm. Because as I said, it can be lonely. And sometimes you just need to talk to somebody who's not involved, who's not inside and in the situation, just to debrief. And then suddenly something makes sense and it clicks. So I'm fortunate in that, the leadership at Jumeirah College and the school leaders that really inspired me there still remain very, very close to me. I still go to them for questions and advice. And I'm very open to admit that I don't have those answers. I'm learning so much, so quickly. But I think that is headship. You kind of, there's the question, isn't there? Are they ready? A lot of people say, are they ready for this stage? Are they ready for SLT? Are they ready for middle leadership? I don't think anyone really ever is. You can't pinpoint when somebody is. There's an element of you've got to go with it sometimes. You've just got to learn and be open to learning and keep learning.
So I suppose in terms of things, maybe two really salient things that you've learnt from your first headship and maybe in a short amount of time, what would they be?
Okay. So I think one of the things that was very different from other leadership roles and headship is I've learned very quickly not to have an answer. And I think particularly being a bit of an insecure overachiever all through school and university, I have this burning need to have the answer. And particularly doing a quant degree, there is a right answer to the problem. That's what I've learned certainly very quickly in the beginning, was that I don't have the answer right now, and not being afraid to say, you know what, let's come back to this. And I'm going to take some time to think about this and discuss it with others and open up to the floor. And it's actually really helped with staff buy-in as well. When you say, okay, you know what, I'm not sure. Let's just talk about this. How do you think we could tackle this? And I think that builds professional enthusiasm. You have teachers in your school who feel that they're having impacts because they're being involved so much in these decisions. So that kind of working party structure has really helped. So not having the answer and being open to the fact that you don't have the answer was something that struck me very quickly. And I think on another sense, the importance of not saying something, and I know it sounds quite obvious, but a lot of leaders will say a lot of things and then it kind of can disappear. A lot of initiatives start and they don't get followed through. And again, one of my old principals, he once said to me, never promise anything in a corridor conversation. So never walk. And he said to anybody, regardless who it is, even if it's a parent who wants you to do it, and you say, yes, I'll do that. Because inevitably you're going to end up juggling so many things. And the minute that a small thing that you have said is not acted upon, there goes your integrity. And it takes a long time to earn integrity, but it's so easily lost. So it sounds like a a fancier way of saying staying organized, but I think it's also just making sure that you're not even having small interactions that mean something could be missed. So ensuring that that's tied up, that the communication, anything you communicate, anything that you say you're going to deliver, you absolutely must.
I suppose it's that sweet spot, isn't it? Because I suppose people, maybe especially new to roles, doesn't matter if it's a leadership position, it could be a teacher, whatever, they kind of feel that they have to have all the answers because it's about credibility. And I suppose if you don't have the answers continuously, people kind of look at themselves and go, well, if I haven't got the answers, then, you know, who am I? Are people going to respect me? Do I still have that? So I suppose in terms of that, Chandani, you know, where do you think is the sweet spot in terms of not having all the answers?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, there's an element of, well, if you don't know anything, why are you supposed to be leading us? Yes, absolutely. And I think there is the swan analogy as well of leadership, isn't there? You're the swan and you're paddling furiously under the surface because you need to ensure that everybody who is looking to you feels that sense of calmness and reassurance that you are there and you're steering the ship, sort of thing. So, it's not about saying I have absolutely no idea, but it's it's being open to the idea that we all make mistakes, but also that sometimes there isn't a right answer. So, let's try something. What do you think about this? And when people feel heard and feel actively listened to, then I think anything that you start, you'll get that buy-in and you'll see it through. There's a danger in that. And I think also it's not just leaders. I think the whole kind of psyche around success, we've come a really long way because certainly when I grew up, I had this perception that my parents had all the answers and I couldn't just Google anything. So I believed very much everything that they said. And it was the same with my teachers and any sort of, I guess, anyone that I respected. And therefore you have this sense of, if you don't know something, you failed in some way because you're supposed to have all the answers. And actually I'm so happy that that has changed. There's real benefits in that and embracing failure. Because I can see why it would put so much strain on school leaders and leaders generally when they feel like they just cannot fail because they must always be right. Because it's inevitable. It is inevitable.
And you mentioned success there, and I suppose I'm kind of firing some deep questions at you now, I suppose, but in terms of your current role, you know, what does success look like for you?
Ooh, you know, interesting. I was asked this by my chair of governors when I was interviewed for the role. And I think success for me looks like a school in which everybody's learning and embraces learning. And that's everybody in the school. That for me is a successful school. And I know there are other metrics, there are other KPIs that would more quantifiably explain what a successful school is. But culture, as I said, is everything. And that's a very big part of the culture. We're fortunate in the region. We have such a diverse population, which I absolutely love. It's one of the wonderful things about living here, but it's therefore naturally an inclusive place to be. We have some very academic schools in the region, and that's also exciting. I am an academic person. That's part of my kind of my values, my ethos. So it's that sweet spot for me. We're academic and we are inclusive, and that's really exciting. I remember when I left the kind of schools that I was teaching in the UK, and I thought, how am I ever going to find something like this when I move, to the UAE? And again, we moved to the UAE with my husband's job. And I thought, oh gosh, you know, how am I going to find schools where I can have this kind of impact? And actually it's quite naive. Because you have impact in any classroom, you have impact in any school. It's what we do. It's our craft to have that lasting impact on young people. So, I've gone off on a tangent there on what success looks like. But continuously loving to learn and finding that love of learning, and you know, away from the Ken Robinson debate of, and what is the purpose of schools, the purpose of education? now that information is so accessible to young people. And I think we have to be tread very carefully around that, because yes, information is very accessible, but guidance is also very important with that information, and encouraging the challenging and the questioning of the information that is accessible is incredibly important. So finding that love of learning, that is now, I think, the calling, if you like, for teachers. Encourage students to find that love of learning, because if you don't love learning, you're going to struggle with your well-being in the future, irrespective of what you do. So as a mum, I'm learning all the time. And it's incredibly challenging, but I love learning new things about parenting as a partner. You're learning all the time. So it's not just about sort of, oh, well, how is this going to help me in my future job, my future career? Loving to learn actually gives you a really good state of well-being, because it's something that we're all going to do in life, irrespective of the walk of life that we choose.
It's interesting what you say there, Chandini, around other bits outside of your work. And I think in terms of organizational evolution, I think very much now it's around that wholeness, isn't it? That wholeness piece. And I think the pandemic's brought that back even more. And I've said on previous podcasts, you know, I mean, I coach people all over the world, and that's kind of developed through the pandemic in terms of not face to face, but online. And you've had a portal into people's lives that you'd never have seen previously. And I think people are now coming to work, and they're, you know, they're coming to school, and this includes parents and students wanting to bring themselves and not necessarily be, say, shoehorned into a certain way of doing things. And I'll maybe be curious, have you found any change since kind of in the last year or so in the outlook or maybe the values of staff, parents, or your community around that?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I've seen teachers upskill so quickly and rise to the challenge of, okay, you know what, we're going to take a school building away and we're going to teach from home. And a lot of these teachers, you know, a lot of teachers don't just have a straightforward place to work from home, because it's never been a profession that anybody's been able to work from home and do. And we did it. We're teaching from home, and students are still learning, students are still making progress. So it is really quite remarkable the way that teachers went on that journey. But it came with its challenges. And I think isolation was very, very real. Huge amounts of anxiety going on in a global pandemic for students and for staff. And then we find ourselves coming back into a school community, but there's still a lot of restrictions. So everyone's excited to come back, but then we're still treading incredibly carefully around the school in terms of what we can and can't do. So I think what I've noticed for staff and students was challenges with confidence. Confidence took a knock because we were in a bit of unknown territory in terms of online teaching, but students are also in completely new territory in terms of online learning. And although they are far more adept and digitally literate and learning digital literacy skills faster than we are, you know, I'm struggling to keep up with some of the young people that I teach. But it still can take a knock on your confidence, because it's not the same as having a conversation in person. We've all seen that now. We miss that human connection. But it's one of the things I'm looking at now is teaching confidence. Confidence can be taught. And I've seen teachers do it. I've seen leaders do it. I've seen parents do it. I've seen coaches do it. Because it comes from inspiration, it comes from challenges, and it comes from a sense of community. And that's what really was missing. Community was certainly very challenging to establish in online learning. Challenges perhaps can be, you know, you could still find a way around. But inspiration also becomes hard, because trying to inspire somebody through, I suppose we're doing it now through a Zoom conversation, is not quite the same as
it's not inspirational
not quite
at
the
all.
Same as doing it in person.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying. And I think I totally agree, actually. I mean, in terms of the work that I'm doing with schools, the amount of schools now are saying, look, we could do it virtually, but staff don't want that. We need to have that connection with people. We need to have that kind of energy around something. because it just needs to go to the next stage. As you said there, you know, it's about, I suppose, connecting with people and building those relationships and that confidence that comes from that in terms of taking things forward.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And confidence is really important, I think, for young people, but not just, and again, it's not the stereotype of the fantastic public speaker who has loads of confidence and who can stand up in large assemblies. It's inner confidence, which means you make informed decisions. Mm. And again, it requires confidence to say, I don't have all the answers. Mm. And so I think it's a really important thing to build on, and something that has taken a knock. So we are seeing that, and getting back into school, being back in a room with students, being back in a room with staff, I think we'll see an exponential increase in that again. I think that's one of the things that is hard to do digitally. Mm. But if anything, the pandemic has taught us the value of that sense of community, a school community. And I think it's opened the world's eyes to our jobs as teachers. We suddenly, you know, we have parents looking at what we do at home, seeing the challenges. And that's been tough on teachers. They're having to change that whole context, teach online with students who are also very new to it. So, yeah, it's very exciting to be back in school. But now, having learned what we have, there's an incredible opportunity to also change and enhance what we can do in schools, because now we can connect with people in a different time zone, as we are doing right now, which wouldn't have previously been possible. Or it may have been, but we hadn't looked at it in this way.
It wasn't
such a norm. Yeah. So I think that's great. And that's something that we will gradually over time see more and more, the reach that we can have as educators, as leaders. I think that's really exciting, the networking that allows for, and therefore the learning that it allows for.
And it's really, really interesting. And we had a quick chat before we came on air, didn't we, around questions that you get asked maybe around that. So in terms of your role, you know, you're pretty new to post. There's been a lot of flux around, you know, education, as you said. So what are some of the questions and maybe the queries that you get asked on a daily basis?
So I get asked a lot about my own leadership journey, and I'm always very happy to explain.
Oh, really? Who asked you that?
A lot of parents. Actually, a lot of parents are very interested. Mm. And I guess, Annie, it's natural. As a school leader, people want to know about you, because you shape so much of the culture, as we said. And being authentic to self. So, I'm very happy to talk about changes in career, because careers are more and more fluid. Mm. And I want students to have the confidence to know that your degree doesn't define you, your grades don't define you. There's so much more to that. And in fact, even having studied at the University of Oxford and going through that process, I had an absolutely amazing time, learned a huge amount. It was very, very tough. But you know, this idea that it's a magical degree that will open any set of doors for you. it's not the case. You still have to prove yourself. And yes, it might look great on a CV, but you have to be authentic to self. You have to be able to get people's buy-in. If you want to be successful as a leader, there's a lot more to it. So I think it's important that students recognize that too. And I get asked a lot about the value of grades, the value of the academic qualifications. Quite often students also now will say, you know, well, that person is making millions on YouTube and Instagram. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know what their GCSE grades are. And yes, that's absolutely valid. I don't know what their GCSE grades are either, but it comes back to that love of learning. And I think successful people do love to learn in whatever facet that is. So yes, whether you found that on Instagram or on YouTube, really, these are still remarkable young people who found something they wish to pursue, who found a passion. and then really thrown everything they can at it and learned and continued to learn on that. And school, what an amazing community to do that in. Because here you have a safe space, you have adults who are going to guide you and foster this love of learning. So that's the answer I would give when I am challenged on, you know, well, what is the future of how we measure the metrics in education? Really, we need to find a way to foster a love of learning. And schools still have stood the test of time with that.
It's really interesting because, you know, as we're having a chat before, that this is where Pursue has an office in the UK. And we're surrounded by people here who aren't in the education sector. And the amount of people, you know, young people just out of universities, so they're 20, 21, even people 18, 19, they're all starting businesses. So you have a chat with people here, which is always really informative. You know, have a cup of coffee and sit down with somebody who, you know, you just don't really know. Oh, so what are you up to then, you know? And it really is about that love of learning. So just because they're not doing it in an academic sense, they're doing these things. They're starting and building a website. They're going to e-commerce. You know, they're going to retail. You know, I've developed a skin moisturizer. I was speaking to someone the other day that hasn't got certain things in it. It's vegan. And, you know, I'm 21 and we're going to trial that at some. And you just think this is all kind of amazing stuff going on. And okay, it's not maybe academic as we would kind of, you know, class it. And they have been through most of them an academic pathway. But there's still lots of commonalities, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. And there's the confidence. I think it's quite remarkable that a young person can turn around and say, you know what, I'm gonna go for this. I'm gonna try and set up my own business. And wonderful. The interest that has come from the access to information is remarkable for young people. You know, the students have an opinion on so much more because they are reading about so much more. And as long as they are carefully guided around the validity of that information, it's great that there isn't that apathy. And I remember that apathy when I was in school. You know, students weren't hugely interested in what was going on in the news. And it was a bit of a, oh, okay, is that happening? Okay, is that important? Does it affect me? Whereas now it's great to see young people really animated about what is going on, the way that they're engaging with the media, and of course, digital revolution with that has enhanced that even more. So there are definitely positives of it. I know we often look at it and think, okay, what is this creating? And, you know, this, what does this mean about learning? Why do we need to learn about the periodic table when I can just Google it? There's so much more.
That's a good question to ask.
School experience.
Yeah, you're right. You know, we could sit here and talk, you know, for a long time, Chandini. You know, you've been an absolute belter of a podcast guest because, you know, you've got so much information and really passionate about what you do. I suppose just to kind of bring this to a close, I suppose, in terms of, you know, what advice you'd give to yourself maybe at the start of your career. And I ask this from a lot of podcast guests, but maybe some thoughts around that.
I think being very open-minded. Certainly, I didn't imagine that I was going to be a teacher at the start of my professional career. And I think that there's a danger in feeling that, oh, if I chop and change too much, like what does that look like in terms of my career? And actually, I think you just have to be open-minded to finding what you love. And often when students say to me, and sometimes parents too, at a very young age or with a very young child, like they love science, so they're going to do medicine. And I just say, that's wonderful. That is fantastic that you know this, but let's just go through life with an open mind because change is the only constant. So as long as we're adaptable to that and open to change and we embrace it, then actually these hurdles and won't seem so big. So I would say ensuring that I stayed open-minded. I don't think I was as open-minded about anything, really, as much as I am now.
I suppose, again, last question, how are you going to ensure that you remain open-minded going forward in your role?
Maintaining humility, I think. Humility, I come back to it again. Yeah. But yes, it's and actively listening to others and connecting with others. Means that you do remain open-minded. And I think, again, it's one of the brilliant things that the pandemic has allowed us to connect with so many people people that we wouldn't normally be able to connect with because we're physically too far away. But I think that naturally makes you more open-minded because you're open and you're hearing so many different ideas and different opinions on things. Mm. So, and I think that makes you humble because you're not the lone correct voice. What is the lone correct voice on these things anymore? So, yeah, I think it comes back to humility. Stay humble, stay open-minded.
A couple of things there from this conversation: humility, stay humble, and stay open-minded are kind of key themes that have come through, haven't they? So really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule in Dubai. And yeah, just thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. I'm sure people find it really, really beneficial.
Not at all. Not at all. It was a pleasure, Nicholas. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. If you're interested in partnering with Pursue through our suite of individual team and school-wide coaching culture awards, please send me an email at hello@pursue.com or visit our website, pursue.com. You can also follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter at Nicholas Mackay or Pursue. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a rating and spread the word. We are proud to have developed a truly global and collaborative community. Take care and look forward to speaking to you again soon.